You're listening to Work Tape, episode 140.
Welcome to this edition of the Work Tape podcast. It's your boy, Money Mitchell, Isaac Reuben Grover.
What's up?
And we are here. We are making it through technical difficulties and lack of sleep.
Both.
And we were going to get into this topic last time. However, we got so bombarded with music news last week that we had to delay this particular segment to this week. And that is the correlation, or I guess the dynamic of trauma and artistry. And, you know, people sometimes wonder, you know, does trauma and struggle always equate to great art?
Or maybe even help.
Well, yeah. Some people have said, or I've heard some people say that a lot of the best music, a lot of the best films, a lot of the best, you know, expressions of art have come from a place of struggle and
pain.
Yes. And you can't talk about this particular topic, especially in regards to music, without mentioning the Jacksons. Michael and the rest of the brothers as well. I mean, the Jacksons are kind of the poster child or poster children, I guess. Mm. They were like kind of one of the first ones, I think, that really got more like mainstream in the sense that it was very like publicized more so than even some of the other ones before. Because not to say that by any means that they were like the first, but I think because the Jacksons were so huge as a group, and then, of course, MJ with the solo career, which set, you know, precedents that people are still trying to match today, I feel as if with the Jacksons, their stuff really got put in the limelight in regards to not only the quality of the music that they were putting out, but, you know, how the music kind of came about. And unfortunately, you know, I think a lot of the issues that Michael ran into later in his life, especially regarding the allegations, which he was acquitted of, but still, you know, he had the allegations. I think it stems from this in the sense that, and actually, I really don't think there's any doubt that it stems from his upbringing, because with working in entertainment from such an early age and basically not really having much of a choice in regards to being in entertainment, he didn't have a traditional childhood. And so when he got older, he tried to recapture or, you know, perhaps have a sort of childhood that he didn't have. And then that's what led to the Neverland Ranch, you know, looking exactly like Disneyland. You know, and then, of course, all of the speculation in regards to, you know, what was he doing with the kids at Neverland Ranch? So I think a lot of that could have been avoided if, you know, there wasn't.
If his needs as a child were just met.
Yeah. And if there was some sort of, you know, balance, you know, between the entertainment and the childhood. And unfortunately, that's what happens also with a lot of Disney and, as we've talked about, Nickelodeon stars too, especially with that doc.
Yep. Quiet on a Set.
Yeah. So unfortunately, that's the case with a lot of these artists in the sense that they get thrusted into, you know, a pretty adult world at a very early age and are kind of forced to grow up. And a lot of times they also become the primary breadwinners of the family. And the real kind of tragedy, I think, more so than any instance, of course, not to say that instances of, you know, the artists getting, you know, beat into things or emotionally abused or whatever is not tragic. That absolutely is 100% tragic. But another real part of this is the fact that some of the family members basically like steal money from the kids because of the legality aspect of it.
Which is why a lot of these children want to separate from their parents when they get older, when they find out how sleazy their parents were.
Right. And, you know, there's different, you know, even like with Britney Spears and her conservatorship, where, you know, she was fully grown, but still under the conservatorship of her dad. And pretty much all that money got, you know, most of it anyway, got sent to him. And, you know, they would claim that, oh, it was, you know, because Britney was mentally unstable or whatever, which, yeah, she did have some moments, especially in the mid-2000s. But once again, it all ties back to the early parts as well, because even with like the Mickey Mouse Club, where Britney Spears got her start, along with Justin Timberlake, Ryan Gosling, and a few others, she seemed relatively, you know, adjusted. But it wasn't until she got, you know, really exploited for her looks. And then basically, it sounds like in a way, she was almost like forced into her sound that she actually got like so well known for. Because there's other videos of her singing when she's younger, and she has like kind of a country twang.
Mm.
And her voice just sounds different. It doesn't have the like nasality.
She's like a reverse Taylor Swift.
Right. You know, she's not singing, you know, the stuff that she got known for. And I guess when people looked into it, it was the decision for her to sing that, you know, style of music, which, yes, she did kind of build her brand off of, was not like necessarily who she was like as an artist. But it was just like, oh, you know, you got the look, you know, we have to sell you basically kind of as, in a way, like a symbol, more so than like Prince, you know, who actually was a symbol, I think.
Yes, he was.
I think he was like the love, he was going by the love symbol, and everybody was referring to him as like the artist formerly known as at that time. So,
you know, honestly, the same time of Britney Spears, you know, 50 Cent and Eminem also kind of went through their stuff.
Yeah. I mean, Eminem definitely had the tragic upbringing too, with, of course, you know, his mom.
I mean, who didn't hear about his mom?
Well, yeah. And then, of course, the drama with his wife or his ex-wife, Kim. You know, which, yeah, that was the thing about Eminem. The thing about Eminem is he publicly aired all of the stuff that he went through. Michael Jackson was not making diss records at Jody.
No, he was not.
And you didn't hear Britney Spears making subtle jabs at her father either.
Nope.
But Eminem said, nah, I'm just going to tell you how it is. And that's going to be part of my brand, is I'm going to be, you know, unfiltered, uncensored, and I'm going to tell you how it is. And I respect Eminem for that, actually, in a big way. He really took a lot of the idea of tragedy turning triumph, I feel like, in a big way. Because I think even now, I think he's still the highest selling rapper, I think, of all time.
I think you're right.
And I think Drake is getting close, but he's still not like fully there yet. Now, some people would say, oh, it's going to be, you know, almost impossible for Drake to get there because Drake is in the streaming era and M made all of his money when, you know, physical records were still king. And so it may be really tough and the parameters are different, but, you know, M has a bunch of records and performance numbers that still haven't been topped, I don't think, by any rapper.
Definitely not by modern standards. So,
yeah. So I think that he's like very much the definition of a tragedy turned triumph in that way. While Eminem has definitely not put out what I would consider his best material as of recent, actually, I think a lot of the best material was in that period, I still give M, like I said, the respect and the flowers that he deserves, even if the recent albums are kind of trash. I mean,
prepare to get dissed, Mitch.
I mean, I'm just going to say it. I mean, like, Revival was not good. Kamikaze was a step in the right direction. Music to be Unalive to, that's not the actual title, but we're trying to keep it a relatively family-friendly program.
Yes.
Here. That last one was okay as well. But just like I said, doesn't match up on the quality anyway in comparison to the other records. See, even my dog agrees with that in the background.
I say hello.
So, yeah, so M is definitely the one of tragedy into triumph. And let's see.
Brian Wilson.
Yeah, that's the one that is surprising probably to a lot of people. There's probably a fair amount of people who may not know that, yes, Brian Wilson, as well as some of the other members of the Beach Boys, had a similar upbringing to the Jacksons in the respect that the dad was a perfectionist and expressed his disdain through violence. And in the biopic of Love and Mercy, even, which is on Brian Wilson, it's an excellent, excellent biopic for those who haven't seen it, because it goes into, of course, Brian Wilson's struggles, as well as it's just a nice kind of like movie on the band too, especially with the making of Pet Sounds, which is their best album, like without really any contention. But Brian Wilson actually became deaf in one of his ears because he got hit so many times. He actually lost hearing on, I think it's like the left side of his ear.
Did that cause him to almost be compared to like Beethoven? Because I could see where people would draw that parallel. I know they're kind of in different leagues. I mean, Brian Wilson's amazing, but I'm not sure if he touches Beethoven. But I can kind of hear the similarities coming as far as the troubled artist and, you know, at least deaf or partially deaf.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some similarities. And I mean, to be honest, even from a compositional standpoint, you could make a decent argument, actually, that Brian Wilson kind of sort of was a modern Beethoven of his day, especially on the Pet Sounds record, which actually had a lot of orchestral and like classical elements in the songwriting.
That's true. I did not think about that. You're right.
I mean, granted, Pet Sounds was kind of like a hodgepodge of a bunch of different sounds. Although what's really interesting about Pet Sounds is that it is kind of, like I said, this hodgepodge or medley of these different styles, but yet it somehow is cohesive. It's pretty amazing, because when a lot of artists will decide to, you know, take on a bunch of different things and, you know, make it like kind of the passion project as it might be, you don't get that level of cohesion. But with Pet Sounds, you did. And I think it's probably in part just because Brian spent so much time with the composition of the songs, and he did get the Beach Boys, the rest of the Beach Boys, to be on it. He kind of strong-armed them a little bit because they weren't like seeing the vision at the time. They thought, oh, it was just kind of an experiment that's not going to sell, but you know, they were kind of wrong in that respect.
Yeah. Literally one of the biggest acts of all time.
Yeah. But there's a lot of great, like I said, compositional work on that. Like I said, there is some classic orchestral influence. There's some jazz influence on that record too.
Yes, there is. They were almost more varied, you know, honestly, maybe even equally varied to the Beatles, even though the Beatles, I felt, were more of a blues and rock outfit, you know? They kind of incorporated more of that, you know, the Eastern sounds, right?
Yeah.
But the Beach Boys definitely, in my opinion, like you're basically saying, more of a hodgepodge of genres. Weren't really always that traditional as far as like American sounding. Like they brought in a lot of stuff that just was kind of unconventional. I thought that was kind of cool. Even though they're not one of my favorites, I do respect them for that very highly.
Right. Well, especially on that record, because the thing was, you know, the Beach Boys were kind of almost like an eight...
The barbershop sound. I love it.
Oh, yeah. The barbershop sound's great. But in a way, the Beach Boys, this is going to sound like an interesting comparison, but hear me out on this. The Beach Boys, in a way, were kind of like AC/DC in the sense that they were making the same song over and over again, basically.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right.
Completely different from a genre and sonic perspective, of course. You know, the Beach Boys singer didn't sound like an orangutan in pain like the AC/DC singer did.
ow, you know, and
that's a rat machine. You know, it wasn't like Marge Simpson became a rock singer.
Didn't they like all take Robert Plant and then just morph it in different ways? And then GNR and all these bands are doing that sound. I feel that's what happened.
Yeah. I mean, but let's be honest, they did better. They did stuff that was more exciting than Greta Van Fleet did with it.
Well, no, they just rehashed.
Yeah.
They just took it from the past and
They didn't do anything different with it, which is
nothing.
You should mention them in that way. Not that there can't be change, but I don't know. I think it's
they're skilled, but they're unoriginal. But that's besides the point. I agree. I agree wholeheartedly because with the Beatles, you know, they did do the orchestral stuff too. What I like about the Beatles more than Beach Boys was how varied they were from album to album.
Right.
I think they're more traditional rock, though, than Beach Boys were.
Yes.
Beach Boys would do the more orchestral, softer sounds, and that was fine.
Yeah.
But yes, you're right. They kind of ended up doing the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
But they're both, you know, both bands were great. I don't really consider one better. I just prefer a sound over another.
Yeah, and I think with the Beatles, like, well, because they were in, you know, competition for a while.
Yeah, and Beach Boys are Californian, so I have to root for them.
Yeah, you know, Beatles put out Rubber Soul. You know, Brian Wilson hears it and is like, okay, we gotta match that.
Yeah.
They put out Pet Sounds. Then Paul McCartney hears Pet Sounds and is like, all right, mate, we gotta make an album that matches that.
That was better than the last one.
And that's, you know, Sgt. Pepper's. And then, you know, the Beach Boys were in the midst of, you know, replying or basically coming up with the equivalent to Sgt. Pepper's. But then Brian Wilson's mental health, like, spiraled out of control at that point, and then it never got finished. That was like the Smile session.
Hmm. You know what's crazy? Nas and Brian have both struck me as people who would have died way earlier than they've lived. Like, I always thought that those would be like legends, you know, like, are they still alive? And I checked, like, they're always alive. So I'm like, wow, I can't believe they haven't, like, you know, unalived themselves or whatever, because that's or they get killed by someone else.
Yeah, I think that's more of the case for Nas. I don't think there was hits out on Brian Wilson.
Yeah. I was definitely relating the getting hit to Nas, but then the unaliving to Brian, because that's typically what happens to people in their respective groups.
Yeah, in the rap genre too. But yeah, no, Nas is definitely, once again, a tragedy turned triumph thing. And, you know, from a very early age as well. I mean, I think he was like, what, 19 or 20 or... He was no older than 21 when he put out Illmatic, which is still considered like one of, if not the greatest rap album of all time by some
sense. I think it's the greatest hip hop record of all time, but that's just me.
It's very good. It's just like it really set a benchmark for lyricism, for beats. He had the best producers on it at the time. We could go into a whole episode about that.
But yes, we were tying in the classical, actually, because you and I were talking about Mozart, and Beethoven for sure also had that whole like abusive father thing. I think he was an alcoholic as well.
Right.
And so like Beethoven had that whole troubled childhood thing. And then Mozart, you said what, his father ran him to the ground, like with like touring or I don't know, like taking him to different places so he could play.
Yeah. So what it was with Mozart is Mozart's father was a composer himself and
makes sense,
had some level of success, but he saw in Mozart that Mozart's ability far exceeded even his ability.
Hmm.
And Mozart was only like, you know, 7 years old or whatever at the time. And so what he decided to do was he did this just relentless campaign where he took Mozart from basically like royal palace to royal palace to play for the monarchies of the time. And eventually, you know, Mozart did land as like the pianist, like as the person in music. But I actually was making also the comparison to Michael Jackson in the respect that both Mozart and Michael Jackson were brilliant in their respective crafts, but both got deprived of childhoods and thus had this kind of, in a way, immaturity. And in a way, they kind of had somewhat of a naivety as well in regards to when they became adults.
Right.
Like Mozart apparently was like very much like a jokester, and he was like a bit of a womanizer, but then he also liked, to put it in a family friendly matter, fecal matter.
Yes. Really? I didn't know that.
Yes. And there was also music that he wrote, which, was written in, I think, either Latin or French or German, but then translated. It's literally like, basically like, guess my gluteus maximus.
Are you serious? You know, that's funny. I'm not sure if I read this somewhere, but I think I might have. That's crazy.
Yes. So he was essentially a pioneer in the sense of making kind of joke party songs even back in the day. You can totally look it up. That's what it literally translates to. Forgot what the name of the actual song is, but
then a couple years back we barely touched on like these really raunchy artists like from the 30s and 20s.
Oh yeah, like the blues artists who kind of like like there's that one blues lady who who set the standard for like Cardi B and stuff, where like, yeah, back in the 20s or the 30s, she was talking about like how her men haven't hung like a baseball bat or something.
Speaking of Cardi B, Nicki Minaj also went through some stuff. We won't go into detail, but you know, for those who want to know, she was one of them as well.
Yeah. And I mean, didn't she have like some ups and downs with the rap career? And then like, she wasn't like Cardi in the sense, because Cardi actually was like stripping too, like to get the money for the records. But I don't think Nicki had to do that. Cardi B was also Bill Cosby-ing people too. That's
when it turned into a verb.
That's the other. How else am I going to put this, Isaac?
I don't know. You're right. I mean, you're not wrong. That's why I'm laughing. You're not wrong.
Oh, she Bill Cosby men with the stuff, yeah, and took their money. So
you know, I'm just a little bitter that little Bill was ruined for me. Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that.
I love that show.
You know, we can't look at the Cosby Show when it's talking about the pudding in the same way either. So who likes the pudding? You know, whatever. I don't know.
Well, actually, really though.
Anyway.
But speaking of the Motown, I want to know, cough, cough, what's going on?
Oh, gosh. Wow, that's very much a
yeah, pun. I know. I was bad, but hey.
Oh, my goodness. But, yeah, so on April 1st, April Fool's Day, was the anniversary of the murder of, or the unaliving of Marvin Gaye. And that's, for me, like I said, knowing my love and admiration for Marvin Gaye as just being probably one of my all-time favorite artists, you know, it's still sad to think about. I still get reminded of it every, you know, point at this time of year. And once again, it was a similar thing where the dad created the environment. But this time, what made this one different, I think, more so than the MJ case, what made it more different than the DeBarges or some of the other ones we mentioned, is that religion played a role in this in a way, because Marvin Gaye Sr. was a pastor. And basically Marvin Gaye grew up in a like very religious, very controlling household from a religious standpoint. And, you know, of course he sang in the church, and they were fine with him singing in the church. But when it came, you know, time to sing at Motown, there was like, oh no, you know, that's not going to happen. You know, it's like the whole like devil's music kind of thing. You know, so that one, it wasn't so much, I think, physical abuse. It was more like emotional and like
psychological. Yeah.
You know, it was so much to the point where the E that's on the end of Marvin Gaye's name, he actually added that E. Originally, his name was Michael. Michael. His name was. They're interlapping. They're overlapping.
They're interfering with each other's spaces.
And it's still early, so for me anyway. So no, Marvin Gaye his original actual like biological name was spelled G-A-Y, but he actually added the E on the end of it to detach from his dad.
You know, I always kind of wondered if that was a misspelling, because of course there could be the G-A-Y. I mean, a last name is a last name. You can make up whatever you want, but I actually kind of thought, I was like, huh, like that's weird that he has an E at the end. So I didn't realize it was attached to his childhood trauma. So he's trying to separate himself from his family. That's very sad.
Yeah, incredibly. And, you know, that's what it came down to.
I don't blame him.
There was just that overbearing nature. And, you know, like I said, unfortunately, religion did play a role in it. I mean, thankfully, it seemed like, especially from the music and interviews, that like Marvin Gaye actually kept his religion, like he didn't lose his religion.
You don't have to, but people, you know, they like to use things for control.
Right. You know, because there's, you know, songs, you know, even on What's Going On, you know, there's like, you know, God is my father, God is my friend. You know, there's literally that whole song.
Yeah, he didn't turn on him because his dad was a bad guy.
Yeah. And it's just, like I said, just the circumstances of how that happened, in the sense that, you know, Marvin Gaye was actually like making a comeback. Like he was out of the mainstream. He had a slump. The albums that he made, one of them was the divorce album, Here, My Dear. But then even the ones following that didn't sell. And then this is the early 80s. So then he comes back with, you know, the Midnight Love album, which won him a Grammy. You know, he came just fresh off of a Grammy at this time and was poised to make a real like return to music.
Right.
And, you know, who knows what kind of songs he would have continued to make like over the production of the 80s. Like, I mean, we have an idea because of that Midnight Love album, but, you know, who knows what he could have done with more of like 808 and synthesized production, especially considering he did incredible things with not nearly as much of the technology. But he did have a drug problem.
Yep.
He was staying at his parents' house at the time. It wasn't his house. And there was just, I guess that's how it happened, is that there was some sort of altercation or conflict with people that Marvin was hanging out with, who were, I think, maybe supplying him the drugs. And the dad just had enough and shot him, basically. And I believe if Marvin Gaye Sr. is still alive, he is very much in jail, but I think he may have died in jail either like last year or the year beforehand, because he was pretty old when he did this. So once again, every April 1st, April 2nd, you know, because of course he got shot right before his 45th birthday, I'm always reminded of this. And unfortunately, you know, it's the tragic end. In a way, I almost wonder, because of the way it ended, if that's a big reason why we haven't gotten the true biopic for Marvin Gaye that they've been talking about doing, because it's been like thrown around like a lot in terms of a proper Marvin Gaye biopic. And I think he definitely deserves one.
I think he deserves the other as well. I think he it goes both ways. Either he does deserve one to show a story, or I think he deserves one to like just rest.
Yeah, but I think that I want to make, if they're going to do a Marvin Gaye biopic,
they have
really,
to make it respectful. They have to do a good job with it.
Well, of course. And I think the issue was, I think they couldn't get the estate on board for a while, which I'm kind of like, I don't like his estate.
I don't think anyone does.
I think they're money hungry and they're greedy.
No, you know they are. You don't even think that.
With all the lawsuits that they've thrown around for artists, you know, copying the same chord progression. I mean, yeah, like, you can't trademark a chord progression, bro. Like, it's just like, come on now. Like, you just want a quick payday. It's just like, it's just terrible. And I mean, I understand that they feel like maybe they want some like, almost like reparations, in the sense that Marvin basically died broke in a way. And so they're figuring like, okay, well, you know, our father, uncle, grandfather, you know, died broke, so we want to make sure that we're getting, you know, every cent of the
money. Nah, man, you have to pay your dues like every other black man out there, all right? I'm going to do it, so they have to do it as well.
All right,
I have a lot to preach in that area.
I wish I had the sound effect with the, like the organ.
Yeah, the organ. The distorted rock organ. But no, there's a lot with these kids that have gone through abuse, and a lot of them have risen up in creativity because of it. Now, there's obviously a catch 22 here, right? You know, they've done some studies and they actually found that artists who had a really difficult childhood, they're more likely to fully immerse themselves in like a creative process, and it can lead to artistic breakthroughs. But even with Beethoven, you know, he was reportedly beaten by his abusive alcoholic father. He wasn't a happy guy, but he was able to channel his inner pain into timeless art. Mm-hmm. And so we notice the same thing with all of these artists, right? So like Eminem, he was able to rise through the ranks as like probably one of the greatest rappers of all time, but it came at a cost. And, you know, the reality is, you know, even though we kind of like respect him for what he's gone through, he doesn't really have nice things to say about the people that wronged him. And that's the bitterness part of it. Like there's usually some sort of resentment that the people have for their parents.
Right.
Or the people that abuse them. And right. That's not necessarily, I'm going to be honest, I'm going to speak for all of these artists. I know most people will say like, oh, you know, I wouldn't change all the things that would have happened to me. You know, I wouldn't do that, right? But most people, what I would say is, I don't think it's worth all the cool things that they got just for them to come out bitter.
Oh, for sure.
The only area where I think they probably shouldn't regret their life and what happened to them is if they came out with a sense of love and more of a sense of forgiveness. I think that's where it's worth it.
Right. Which was the case for those who have, in some instances of those who have survived all of this. And to close it out in a way, the one thing I think that's going to be really helpful now, as opposed to back in all of these respective eras, is that mental health is so much more of a focus now than it was ever in any of the eras that we mentioned.
Very true.
Pretty much in terms of mental health advocacy, it didn't really exist in a lot of these periods of time.
Was it Gen X or the millennials who started it?
I'm not exactly sure, but I just know that there's, you know, been a big stigma around mental health for a long time in terms of seeking it out.
Right.
The idea of being in therapy is, you know, has a certain stigma as well. So I think in a way with this era now, I don't think you're going to have as many, or hopefully you won't have nearly as many instances of this kind of thing occurring, because there's going to be that emphasis and resources available in terms of destigmatizing mental health. It's not destigmatized so much to where it's like, you know, widely accepted or like at the point where, you know, I'd like it to be, where it is, you know, kind of a therapeutic thing and, you know, a necessary thing to do, but it's getting there, I feel like.
I think I agree.
Especially with the pandemic and whatnot happening over the last couple of years, the focus on mental health has really got significant.
I think a lot of it's because of kind of the economy and how things have, you know, everything's so pricey. And
yeah,
you know, when things are harder to advance, I think people start to reflect on why they're not advancing. And so any excuse they can make, and I'm not saying that there aren't any legitimate ones.
Yeah.
But I think excuses become non-legitimate when you don't do anything about it.
Right.
But it's okay to look at why you're not advancing. And I don't think that's a bad thing at all.
Yes. So I want to kind of just bookend it on that note and kind of keep things a little more optimistic. And to segue a little bit into a different topic here for the next episode, as I was sorting through the music news of recent, speaking of birthdays, Pharrell Williams celebrates a 51st birthday, which that man is 51. It's unbelievable.
That's unbelievable. Yeah.
I think he is a vampire because he just...
He doesn't age.
He looks too good. And I mean that like in the best way possible. Like he just looks amazing. He looks not a day over like 30 or 35.
He's like that never aging uncle.
Yeah. But Pharrell put out an album. He put out an album called Black Yacht Rock. It's a 10-track album, surprise album. It's only available on his website for download, which once again, as you and I have talked about before, leads to the discussion of more of the direct-to-consumer kind of approach.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the, I guess, I don't want to say resurgence of direct-to-consumer, but I think this is... well as some of the other initiatives like the James Blake thing, as well as even what Kanye may end up doing with the next installments of Vultures, I think you're going to see more of this direct-to-consumer thing. And I would like to talk about the direct-to-consumer aspect as well as the actual music on the next episode. So this has been the Work Tape Podcast. Money Mitchell, Isaac Ruben Grover. Be good to one another, and much peace and love.
Peace.